From the system of rigging woven around the iron fist, a cable descended straight to the equator. Slowly at first, then building speed, the POV descended, achieving in a few seconds what would have taken several days in any kind of realistic elevator. Even through a screen of bright clouds, Cathree could pick out the complex landforms of Southeast Asia to the north and, to the south, the huge dun slab of Australia, now joined to New Guinea by a lumpy gray-green tendril. The POV chose to zoom down on that first, coming close enough that it became possible to see a road traversing the land bridge. Then it veered and banked onto a northwesterly course, following the green, steaming spine of New Guinea to the cape at its end, where it nearly touched the equator. There, construction was visible. Cleared land, buildings, excavations, a hazy web of infrastructure, glimpsed but not lingered on. The POV soared out over a turquoise sea, cluttered with landforms she recognized vaguely from having seen them on maps. But after a few moments, her eye was drawn to something that was flagrantly unnatural, looking as if it had been drawn in with a ruler and a pencil, the tether from the Kulak, plunging vertically into the ocean between two big islands. These, she realized, had to be Borneo and Sulawesi, and the water between them, the Makassar Strait. The POV's movement slowed, then stopped. The symphony and the choir were laboring through a slow crescendo. A change, more felt than seen, came over the display. The programmed camera movement was finished, and the VARP was now responding once again to Cathree's movements. Like a giantess bestriding the strait, she could move around and look at it from different angles. For a moment, nothing really happened. Then her eye picked up turbulence in the sea, around where the tether stabbed into it. The surface was welling up and foaming. The tiny wrinkles of normal surface waves were erased, replaced by vast green whorls and galactic arms of swirling foam. Bending forward, she saw angry gulls wheeling about. That detail convinced her that what she was seeing was real, not a rendering. The disturbed region grew north and south, spreading away from the cable, which she knew to be on the equator, without growing east-west. The cable forked, then forked again, becoming a fan that broadened north and south to support the full length of whatever was roiling the strait. It erupted from the surface first at the equator, then proceeded to rip a gash in the sea that spread up and down the meridian with immense velocity. The object could hardly be observed at first for all the water draining from it, plunging in multiple Niagaras back into the sea and hurling up a storm front of spray that rose higher than the structure itself. But in a minute, the gnomon became visible. Cathree had to back away to get a picture of the whole length of it. She extended her left hand and made a counterclockwise knob-twiddling gesture, reducing the volume of the Kyoto Philharmonic's brass section before the bass trombones and kettle drums imploded her skull. If the designers of the gnomon had intended to make the anti-cradle, they could hardly have done better. It had the long, wicked curve of a katana, the better to follow the curvature of the earth, combined with the translucent delicacy of an insect's exoskeleton. Indeed, it seemed to be unfolding, reshaping itself as it rose into the air, an origami praying mantis molting into a larger body. Its manifold corrugations and arching carapaces spoke of a million djinns toiling in cubicles for centuries to build the strongest thing they could imagine with minimum weight. "What's it made of?"
"Carbon and magnesium, mostly," said Arjun. "Two light, strong materials that can be extracted from ocean sediments."
"Is that how they did it?"
"Yes," said Cantabrigia V. "Energy intensive," Arjun remarked. "They ran power down the tether to a production facility on the ocean floor."
"They had workers living on the ocean floor?"
"Robots."
"And therein lies an opportunity," said Cantabrigia V. The producers of this spectacle had once again seized control of the POV and begun taking Cathree on a forced march up the length of the gnomon, slowing down to linger on the good bits and zooming past what was repetitive.
She got the idea, which was that it had a sort of carriage that could move north-south on a giant rail and connect with the ground along a range of latitudes. That it had its own internal train lines connecting residential pods, military installations, luxury resorts for the whole family, and so much more. It was obviously rendered, stuff that hadn't actually been built yet. Her inability to control what the POV was doing made her a little queasy. She levered the earbuds up, closed her eyes, and carefully pulled the VARP away from her face. Then she opened her eyes on reality, the beach, the islet, the two interlocutors. She handed the VARP back. What sort of opportunity? If you are going to make first contact with an intelligent alien race, said Cantabrigia 5, dropping huge strip-mining robots into their homeland might not be your best move. Cathree pondered that one for a bit. Ah, she said. Yes. So there's a reason why they were so keen to make nice with the diggers. Having fucked it up spectacularly with the pingers. Yes. Cantabrigia 5 stared at her for a little while. Her silence and her gaze were impressive, yet Cathree did not feel wholly uncomfortable. Finally, she went on. Actions taken here today will cast long shadows into the future of New Earth. With more resources here, we might have effected a more elaborate strategy with less uncertainty. But the mere fact of having had more would have spoiled it.
How did you guys come up with all this? Ty asked.
He was squatting on the islet next to the psych, who was still swaddled in sleeping bags, only her hands and head exposed. She was holding an instruction manual, angling it toward the light of the flink chain. This was still illuminating the cove, but the crew of Ark Darwin had dimmed it so that people could sleep. She had to focus intensely to read the words, many of which must be unfamiliar to her. Her lips moved slightly as she parsed unfamiliar Cyrillic characters sprinkled through almost every word. Headphones buried her ears in great donuts of foam. She hadn't heard Ty, didn't know he was looking at her. So he had his fill of looking for a minute. She wasn't his type, and anyway she was very young. But he was beginning to see what Einstein saw in her. Einstein had to know that there was nobody for him on his riz, no indigent girl he could have an interesting conversation with. And yet if he were to somehow find his way to the habitat ring, he'd be looked on by all the smart girls there as a hillbilly. The device in the box was a portable sonar rig. It was capable of sending out pings, but that wasn't how they were using it. They were using it to listen. Sonar tax law had virtually wrenched it from Ty's grasp and mastered it. The arrival of Ark Darwin and the movements of the boats and the barge had caused her no end of annoyance, but with a little encouragement from Ty, she'd begun to see it as an interesting science experiment, a way of understanding what those technologies must sound like to pingers and other mammals that frequented the deep. Moving carefully on the steep, glassy surface of the islet, he edged into her peripheral vision and gave her a light tap on the shoulder. He hated to break her out of her reverie, but there were questions he needed answered. She was stunned for a moment, as if she'd just been teleported into this location from 1,000 miles away, but rapidly she came around and pulled one of the headphones away from her ear.
Come again?
All of this. Ty rested a hand on the battered plate atop the pipe, nodded toward the makeshift sledgehammer.
How did you come up with it? How do the pingers know that when they want to talk to you, they should build a cairn on the beach at such and such place?
We began sending out scout parties as soon as the atmosphere became breathable, Sonar said.
Let it be 300 years ago, Ty said.
282.
Just making the point that this is old history.
Not that old.
Ty heaved a sigh. Not within living memory.
It is not merely an oral tradition, if that's what you're getting at, Sonar said. We maintain written records.
On 100% cotton paper, yes, go on.
There was nothing for the scouts to eat, of course, so they could only range as far as they could go with food that they carried on their backs. But in time they discovered edible seaweed and bivalves along the coast.
Ty nodded. Once Terraform's engineer Algy had done its job of building the atmosphere, it needed to be held in check. Terraform seeded the coasts with filter feeders and the oceans with krill.
Those clams were the first meat anyone had eaten in 4,700 years, said the psych. Scout parties that hugged the coast could stay out as long as they wanted and roam for months or years, eating better than the diggers who stayed in the hole.
Being a scout must have been popular.
Too popular. Some went rogue and had to be hunted down and subjected to the discipline of the committee.
That sounds unpleasant.
It was not a good time. A lot of what you see that is bad in our culture started in those years.
Anyway, these scouts would emerge from the hole, said Ty, and make a beeline for the nearest coast.
Exactly, and this route we have been traveling is like a game trail for us. We know it backwards and forwards. Well, at some point, after discipline had been reestablished, a scout party was exploring the coast a few kilometers from here, making camp up in the trees. One of them looked down and saw a person just walk up out of the sea. This person carried a little shovel, like you might use to dig clams, and had a basket, but no clothes. He or she dug some clams and tossed them into the basket, and then strolled back down into the ocean and disappeared.
No scuba gear, no wetsuit.
Correct. Just a belt with a knife. Well, word of this got back to the hole, and they talked to a predecessor of mine.
A previous sonar tax law, you mean?
Yes. A scout party went back down to the same place the next year and set up a contraption like this one, except not as good, and used it to send signals out into the deep. Nothing. Years, then decades went by. All they had to go on was the one sighting. Some old digger who had been on a lot of scouting parties came up with the idea of building a bigger and better noisemaker here. He reckoned that the shape of the crater would act as a horn, channeling the sound outwards. To make a long story short, it worked. Contact was made.
How recently?
About 50 years, Sonar said. Then it was broken off around the time that you had your war. 5 years ago, though, we began to see cairns.
Cath-3 was awakened much as Cath-2 had been on the morning when she had seen the digger from her glider, by a certainty that something was out there, supported by no real evidence. This time, she was responding to sound, something she'd heard while still asleep, accessible only through a memory that eluded her the harder she reached for it. She rolled over onto her belly, propped herself up on her elbows, aimed her face uphill, closed her eyes, opened her mouth, and froze. For the first few minutes, she wasn't trying to hear anything, just taking in the ambient soundscape so that she could detect any noises that did not belong in it. The flink chain on that barge was still operating, producing a steady note that could be filtered out by the mind's neural circuitry. She was aware that Bard, too, had suddenly become very quiet, but she didn't know whether he had heard something or was simply following her cue. Cath, too, might have been bookish and unobtrusive, but Cath-3 was the sort of person who kept nearby men on their toes. She heard it again, the same sound that had probably awakened her in the first place. And this time, she knew what it was. Hand-forged steel arrowheads clinking faintly in a quiver, like coins in a pocket. The dilemma of the digger-hunter being that those shafts had to be held loosely enough to be fluidly drawn and knocked, but not so loosely that they jangled with each footfall. In measured strides across level ground, their kit might make no noise, but in a breathless pre-dawn descent of an uneven slope, things might work themselves loose. As that aural picture sharpened in her mind, she could sense footfalls, too, and hear bodies pushing through the brush. The party, she guessed, was more numerous than the jangling quivers. Another Cath-2 memory connected. Preparing for survey work in areas with a lot of indigens,
She had read ancient histories of the American West, where white men had made use of aborigines as scouts and guides. Langobard was hearing things too now, and had begun knuckle-walking along the little picket line that they had established below the rim of the crater, quietly waking Roscoe's Yur and Belid Tomov. Kath-3 followed him, going to each man in turn and saying in a low voice, "Maybe two diggers with bows and arrows, guiding a small unit of Neoanders." "How small?" Belid asked. "Probably not a full peloton. I will guess it is half of the group we observed landing."
"Go and notify Ty," Belid said. "Tell him to turn the light on."
And since it was too dark to see anything, he put a hand on the top of her shoulder, just where it curved up toward the neck, and gave the muscle there a pleasurable squeeze. Then he flattened his palm against her shoulder and gave her a firm shove downhill. A minute later, she was down on the beach. Sonar Taxlaw was still sitting out on the islet, wearing headphones. Einstein was snoring in a sleeping bag. Ty was sleeping in one of the little pop-up shelters that had been supplied by the people from Ark Darwin, which was still anchored offshore, detectable by the slap of waves against its hull. As for Issa Arjun, she nearly collided with him, for he was simply standing there on the beach, robed in the sleeping bag. Odds were 50-50 that he was silently meditating, or that he had gotten up to take a piss. Ivans could be a little funny when their brains got the better of them. Either way, whether he was pissing or thinking, he was temporarily useless, and so she went straight to the shelter and awoke Tayura Tom Lake. That took a bit longer than she had been hoping for, which frustrated her greatly, since it was now so obvious to her that something was happening up above. She could hear the building whine of the body-orbiting flink chains that Neoanders employed as both armor and weapons, but could not tell whether this was Langobard getting ready to mount a defense or the interlopers coming down the hill. The latter she could easily hear now. They had abandoned stealth in favor of haste. "They're coming," she said. "Two diggers, some Neoanders." Ty reached for his catapult, then remembered yet again that it had been taken by Ariane. "Belid says to turn the light on." She was expecting him to use some sort of electronic device, the sort of thing the diggers lumped together under the heading of radio. But instead, Ty rolled up to a seated position, bolted out of the shelter, and simply walked down the beach, hopping and cursing as his bare feet unerringly found stones.
"Turn the light on," he shouted. He cupped his hands around his mouth. "Hey! Turn the light on!"
In this quiet cove, his words were loud as dynamite. Kath-3 heard some kind of answering shout from the direction of the barge, and from the boulder, a hissing noise.
"Shh, shh."
She thought it was the waves surging against the stone until the flink chain began to glow, illuminating Sonar Taxlaw, who had stood up and turned around to face them. She was shushing them with a finger pressed against her lips.
"Shh, be quiet," she insisted.
"Full blast," Ty shouted. "All you got."
"They're coming," said the psych.
And seeing that no one else cared, she caught the eye of Arjun, who had dropped his robe on the beach like a puddle and was advancing toward her, striding directly into the surf.
"We're hurting their ears."
She heard shouting up above, fighters who had dropped all pretense of stealth and were closing for combat. The timbre of their voices was that of Neoanders. Suddenly feeling a desperate need to be up there in the fray, Kath-3 spun on her heel, getting ready to sprint back up the slope. She nearly collided with Cantabrigia 5.
"You are going back up?"
"I feel like I have to," Kath-3 said.
"Godspeed, remember, no damaged diggers."
Cantabrigia 5 pivoted away from her in a manner that made the long skirts of her warm cloak flare beautifully and gave Kath-3 a last look at her regal profile, her excellent posture, emphasized by close-cropped hair. As Kath-3 scrambled back up, she reviewed the more detailed instructions that Cantabrigia 5 had given her some hours ago. "Stay clear of our buckies." Those would be camera-carrying buckies, shooting video of whatever was about to happen. they'd be programmed to look for clear, high ground.
Kathryn dropped to a low crouch, perhaps 50 meters shy of Langobard. She could not see him, but she could hear the flinks careering around him as they whacked into small branches. Above and to her right, a boulder projected from the slope. It was too hard and too steep to support anything except moss. The pale stone was prominent in the directional light of the big A-train below. A sapling had found a perch on its top, grappling the rock with a mostly exposed root system, and reaching toward the sky with a few scraggly boughs that had been sculpted by the wind from the sea. Near it she saw movement, which she identified as a bucky rolling into position atop the boulder. She could see it, so it could see her. She flattened herself behind a particularly dense knot of shrubs and grass, and used her ears, which was about all she had to go on just now. Clink, clink. There it was, the sound, again, of those hand-forged digger arrowheads jostling in their quiver, drowned out by the building whine of a nearby flink chain, reconfiguring itself under the command of its owner. She risked looking up and saw a neoander coming out into a place from which he had clear air to that bucky on the boulder. It wasn't barred. It was a red grunt in military kit. He reached out and closed his right hand on one of the chains flying around him, arresting its movement. At the same time, the chain parted on the opposite side of his body and turned into a whip. It lashed out directly at the bucky on the boulder. Its shape and course were visible at first. Then it accelerated through the sound barrier and became invisible, known only by its results. A sonic bang, the complete disintegration of the bucky, and the toppling of the little sapling cut clean through. The whip slowed as it arced back in the general direction of its owner, and, like a snake in space, reorganized itself into another flying A-train, spinning in the opposite direction from before. Having thus eliminated a robotic sentry on what to him was the left flank, the Neoander drew back toward the center of the action and disappeared from Kath3's view. Kath3 moved toward the boulder. The destruction of one of Cantabrigia V's video buckies made it a good place for her to be. She was churning headlong toward the base of the rock, wondering how she was going to find her way to the top, when movement above caught her eye. She stopped and looked steeply upward at a digger who had just emerged onto its crown to claim the vacated high ground. He had come down the slope so impetuously that he nearly overran the top of the boulder. He had to plant a foot, just short of disaster, and wheel his arms backward to regain his balance. As he did so, the arrowheads clinked together in his quiver. Kath3 froze and crouched, watching him regain his equilibrium. Had he looked straight down, he'd have seen her, but he had eyes only for what was going on to his right, judging from sounds, the beginnings of a confused fight in a cluttered place. The digger reached back, drew out a single shaft, and knocked it to his steel bow, looking out over the scene of the action below. He was thinking about choosing a target when Kath3's ambot hit him in the shoulder and sent him down twitching. Shooting the man had been easy. Not in the physical sense. That would have been easy in any case, since he was standing right there and the ambot was largely self-aiming. It had been psychologically easy. Days ago, when she'd been in the worst part of her shift, barely conscious, she'd overheard Ty speaking to Einstein. Fighting isn't about knowing how. It's about deciding to. Even in her delirium, she had understood that the decision Ty spoke of wasn't an intellectual one. It was an overcoming of the emotional barrier that, in any civilized society, prevented people from doing damage to each other. She knew that because, hours earlier, she had done it. During that shocking initial combat between the Seven and the Diggers, she had stepped in to protect Ty after Arion had shot him, and the old digger had struck her on the arm with the Srap Tasmaner, bruising the bone, and something about that intense physical contact had pushed her through the barrier, made it easy to aim her catapult at the man and fire it. Since then, well-meaning members of the group had approached her to offer their sympathies. All they'd wanted to talk about was Doc and Memmi, and what a shock it must have been for Kath to lose them so suddenly.
Implicit was that Kath had gone epi because of their deaths. A reasonable-seeming assumption, but wrong. It had happened, rather, in the moment when the old man had attacked her and she had fought back. Doc, at the time, had still been alive, and Memmi, though mortally wounded, had still been breathing. So Kath, too, had actually been the first member of the Seven to die. Anyway, she was now the sort of girl who shot people. Useful to know. This all happened on what Blue would consider its right flank, and Red would call its left. As Aboriginal scouts supporting regular forces, the diggers would stay on the wings or out in front, which would imply that the other digger, she was increasingly certain that there were exactly two of them, was likely to be on the opposite flank. The boulder itself was too steep to climb, but ashy talus had spilled to either side of it, forming loose ramps. She churned up one of these and gained an altitude where she could flatten herself against the slope and peer across the battleground. It was contained within a broad, shallow sump where water finding its way down from the slopes of the coastal range was dammed up against the outer wall of the crater. It was heavily grown over, and so its boggy nature was not evident until one set foot in it. Bard, Bellad, and Roscoe Seor had moved aggressively forward, made a show of force, then withdrawn to let the Red Force get literally bogged down. Acting in Blue's favor were difficulties in communication between, on the one hand, tightly organized high-tech Red troops, and on the other, Aboriginal scouts, who only knew about wireless communications because a long line of psychs named Probosidia Rubber had memorized the radio entry. Anyway, Kath-3 was now well forward of her compatriots, off to what they would call the right side of the bog. In order to reach its opposite flank, she could try going straight across, but this would bring her directly into the envisioned path of the Red Grunts, as well as trapping her in the marsh. She could cut back toward the sea and run along the camp where they'd slept last night, but she already knew that most of the Buckies were stationed there. Or she could proceed farther inland and run through the pine forest that rose above the uphill side of the bog. That would take her directly across Red's line of advance, which seemed like a bad idea on the face of it. But the Reds were just an isolated hit squad, not the vanguard of a larger force. They did not have lines of communication back to their rear. Once they had put ground behind them, they had no claim to it, no power there. Given that she could move over rough ground faster than even Bellad, and given that she could hear the Neoanders a mile away, she liked her chances. So she kept moving uphill, rather than down, staying well off to the flank until she had gained a bit of altitude, then turning her attention inward. The Red Neoanders were clearly audible. All but one of them were below her, and as she paused and waited, she heard the thudding footfalls of the straggler going by her. They were getting orders from their B, or Beta, as per racial stereotype. To her credit, the B was not hanging back and commanding from the rear. She seemed to be in the thick of things, which placed her downslope just where the going started to get marshy enough to give them second thoughts about the way they were heading. They must have noticed by now that the native scout on their left had disappeared, which might encourage them to steer toward the right. In any case, they were briefly stymied. They were all downhill of Kath-3, and they were all facing the other way. Looking directly across the slope, she saw nothing but tall, pine-like trees, forming a canopy that had stifled development of undergrowth. It would be easy going. A traversing run would take her rapidly to the opposite side of the field of battle, where she ought to be able to follow the other digger's trail down to wherever he'd stationed himself and zap him with an ambot before he was able to do anything heroic and stupid. The bang of a Neoander's flink whip sounded from below, and she heard someone cry out and a clamor of wanging noises as ambots were projected toward targets. Feeling suddenly very late, she began to run through the trees, moving openly now. When gaps appeared, she looked down across the bog. The vantage from here was excellent, which explained why she nearly collided with a lone man who had stationed himself in one of those clear places, perfectly situated to overlook the bog and the cove below. His only company was a robot, a Psywai with a video camera for a head, capable of rising up out of its coils like a cobra from a basket and aiming its lens in any direction. The man was standing with his back to the fight, facing his Psywai, which was shooting down the hill. Cath 3 was quite close to that Psywai when she stumbled upon this, and so when she first took it all in, she understood the setup exactly, just as a billion red viewers would be doing in a few minutes. In the foreground, the man, framed in rugged rocks and trees that would fill habitat dwellers with that aching need to come down here and colonize the surface. In the near background, the bog, where the fighting was underway. Beyond that, the cove, nestled between the pincers of wave-beaten rock, the flink barge with its column of light making the whole scene come into day, Ark Darwin farther out, rocking slowly on low seas, and the sky adding some light of its own as the dawn approached. The man wasn't expecting her. She got the impression, somehow, that he'd been rehearsing, going over his lines, clearing his throat, preparing for a performance. So she had a few moments in which to stare at him. The three incarnations of Cath Amalthova had, in their collective lifespan, only laid eyes on live Arateics a few times, and then only from a distance. So she had no clear measure of what counted as impressive or handsome among that race. But this one had to be one of the finer specimens. He must be over 2 full meters in height. His long raven hair was swept back from his forehead to make the most of a high, noble brow, a strong, prominent nose, large, jet-black, deep-set eyes. A few creases on his face gave him an air of sober maturity. 5,000 years ago, aristocracy had died, along with almost everything else, and yet the idea of aristocracy, the aspirations that it, at least in an idealized form, drew out of the human psyche, lived on in everything about this man's appearance, his attire, his posture, and the way in which he gazed upon Cath 3 when he had recovered from his astonishment and understood what was happening. The look on his face said that this unexpected encounter was fascinating, as well as slightly amusing, the sort of twist of fortune that happened from time to time to sophisticated persons, and that, political differences notwithstanding, the two of them might one day discuss the whole affair wryly over a glass of fine red wine from Antimer. Or at least that was the case, until Cathry's ambot struck him right in the middle of his forehead. Sensing movement, and hearing the discharge of her catapult, the Psywai, which apparently had some rudimentary ability to follow what was interesting, swiveled in her direction, but she stomped at its neck from behind. It gave way beneath the impact of her heel and made a creditable effort to remain standing, but was forced to uncoil itself so as to effect a soft landing on the ground. From there it might have pursued her into the trees, had it been programmed for pursuit. But it was really nothing more than a moderately smart camera platform, and so it stayed where it was, doggedly trying to center the face of the Arateic in the middle of its frame. Since the Arateic was rolling and writhing like a man on fire, this gave its algorithms a vigorous workout. Cath 3 resumed her headlong run through the trees. She bent her course back toward the sea, entering the final leg of a U-shaped career around the bog. She slowed down. If her conjecture was correct, she must be drawing close to the other digger. And unlike Bard, Bellet, and Roscoe's Ewer, she had nothing to protect her from those steel-headed arrows. She heard a creaking noise from uphill, behind her. She turned around to see a red-headed, blue-eyed digger, no more than 5 meters away, holding an arrow at full draw, aimed right at her. The freshly sharpened edges of its hand-forged steel warhead made bright arcs as they reflected the light from the cove. She had holstered her catapult to leave both hands free for scrambling. She had nothing. Cantabrigia 5 hadn't exactly commanded her to incapacitate both of the digger scouts, just to prevent them from doing harm and to prevent their dead bodies from showing up on video screens around the ring. "You're making a terrible mistake," she said. The digger didn't move, but he did blink slowly. She took it as assent to keep talking. "Those people, the Reds, are only pretending to be your friends, so that they can piggyback on your claim to the surface. They want to take it all for themselves." "And you?" he asked. Blue is no better in some ways.
Then why should we heed your counsel?
You should heed no one's counsel blindly, neither mine nor his. She made a little movement of the head toward the Arataic. Silence, as he considered it.
Do you know Salon Congreve? She asked.
Of course.
Has Salon Congreve spoken to you of chess?
We do not need a psych to tell us of chess, the digger said. We play it all the time.
Then you know that pawns are weak, except for when their position on the board gives them power. Early in the game, they are sacrificed freely. Late in the game, they may checkmate the king.
She was interrupted by another whip crack from below, followed by two more in rapid succession. She fought the temptation to turn around and look. The digger's blue eyes strayed toward the battlefield, took something in, then returned to her. At no time did the arrowhead waver. Cathree continued,
You are pawns. You can't begin to imagine how small and weak you are compared to the forces above. If you allow yourself to be played as such by Red, you will be sacrificed as soon as it suits their purposes. If you play a longer game, though, you can yet grow powerful as the other human races.
With a suddenness that made Cathree flinch, the digger raised his weapon and relaxed the arm that had been drawing the arrow back. He plucked the nock off the string and placed the arrow back in his quiver.
I take your words with a grain of salt, he said.
Good.
But some of what you say confirms suspicions that I have harbored in my breast since the coming of the Red People, and so I have made up my mind to go back and speak to the others of these matters.
And then he simply turned his back on Cathree and began hiking back up into the mountains of Beringia.
I know your story, Tyura Tom Lake, said Cantabrigia V, or at least the portions of it that have made their way into official records.
Half of it, then.
Be that as it may, I sense how distracting this must be for you.
She made the tiniest suggestion of a glance up the slope. Even though her eyes were screened by the lenses of a stylish VARP, their golden hue magnified the gesture.
Part of you wishes to join the battle. That's commendable, but I need you. The purpose needs you. Here.
Fine. You have my attention, Ty said.
Inappropriately, irrelevantly, he was wondering how old this woman was. Epigenetic shifts could roll back many of the visible effects of aging. At least one Moiran, Jamaica Hammerhead 12, had lived to the age of 200. Ty's estimate of Cantabrigia V's age increased by a decade every time he interacted with her. Currently, he was thinking that she might be 80 years old.
What do you know of the Pingers? She asked.
In all honesty, they sound more myth than fact.
Myth carries more weight anyway, in times like these.
What do you know of them? Ty demanded.
For once, Cantabrigia V seemed a little off balance. She looked at him sharply, lifted her VARP, rested it on the top of her head.
I need to know, Ty said, whether they came out of some Red gene lab.
Red doesn't even know they exist, said Cantabrigia V.
Did we make them?
Blue?
No, your hypothesis was correct, Ty.
And how would you know what my hypothesis was?
Her eyes strayed to the pizza box, which was leaning against a boulder that protruded from the beach.
I know what is in there.
Thank you, Ty said.
He turned away from her and began striding in the direction of a tall young Ivan, standing on the beach and gazing up nervously toward the sounds of battle.
Einstein, eyes on me. Time for you to make history.
Cracking a whip made of small robots joined end to end into a long, flexible chain was neither an especially bad nor an especially good way of engaging a foe in ambot-based combat. Extensive studies conducted within Blue Military Research Labs had concluded that, on average, it was somewhat less effective than the more obvious procedure of just shooting individual AMBOTs out of catapults. A dissenting opinion held that such studies were flawed because they failed to take into account two factors that were important in actual battle. One, the psychological impact on a defender who knew that the attack might literally whip around and come at him from any direction, including around corners or over barricades. Two, the element of skill, which was difficult to measure scientifically. The test subjects wielding those things in the lab were unlikely to have the same knack for it as Neo-Anders, who had grown up using them and who had access to an ancient body of lore, a martial art, in effect, that they were disinclined to share with anyone else. If the whip was allowed to dissociate in mid-crack, then its component AMBOTs would be flung toward the target at supersonic velocity, which was as good as could be achieved by shooting the same objects out of a catapult. If it made contact with the target, direct physical damage would be inflicted, and the AMBOTs that had inflicted it could decouple themselves and carry out their usual programs. And if the whipcrack was off target, the chain could be recovered in full with no waste of ammunition. All the AMBOTs came back for another attempt, something that certainly could not be said of ones that had been fired out of cats. On Cathree's list, if they ever got out of this, was to sit down over a glass of Pinot Noir with Langobard and ask him where he had picked up his skills in this department, since, until recently, he had been sustaining a fairly credible cover story about being a peaceful wine merchant in Cradle. She already suspected that he would deflect any such questions by saying that the Antimer Neo-Anders, like many cultures throughout human history, had a tradition of teaching martial arts to their young ones. A skeptic might remark that fighting with whips made of little robots might be all well and good in the clean and well-ordered confines of a space habitat, or a hollowed-out asteroid, or when dueling in spacesuits in a vacuum, or in relatively uncluttered places, such as deserts and ice caps on the surface. But in a bog full of dense, head-high vegetation, it was simply a mistake. Cathree's ears were taking in vast amounts of data that her brain didn't know what to do with. Someone who had grown up practicing these arts, as Langobard apparently had, might have been able to hear nuances in these repetitive bangs. A crack that landed on its target would sound different from one that dissociated into a burst of flying AMBOTs, which in turn would sound different from the one that had whipped back toward the attacker or gotten fouled up in vegetation. Instead of which, all she could tell was that they were fighting down there. By the time she had completed her circuit of the bog and returned to their original line of defense above the cove, they had been fighting for rather a long time, which she interpreted as good news. She was trying to think like Cantabrigia V, who probably wouldn't worry so much about trivial matters like casualties and the control of the battlefield. More important was the narrative of the battle. And so far what it looked like was that a small blue group conducting treaty-approved survey operations on their side of the treaty-defined boundary had been pursued by bloodthirsty red Neo-Anders until trapped against the ocean, where they were now putting up a heroic and surprisingly prolonged last-ditch stand to protect a few non-combatants. Cathree didn't wish this to be cynical, for Cantabrigia V really was a fantastically appealing and charismatic person, but she suspected at some level that a blue fatality or two up in the bog and perhaps an on-camera interview with a maimed and bereaved survivor might be the perfect counter for the propaganda coup that the Arataics had scored a few days ago. Thoughts such as those were luxuries she could not afford herself until she had reached a position above the cove, well behind the battle zone. And, no coincidence, also behind the line of camera-carrying buckies recording the heroic rearguard action. She looked down at the lower camp. A sunrise, in weather like this, was too much to ask for, but the sky was getting brighter all the time and was now illuminating the beach more effectively than the towering Aitken loop on the barge. Perhaps in response to the sounds of battle, half a dozen or so inflatable boats had emerged from the flooded hull of Ark Darwin and begun making their way in, each carrying a few people who appeared to be wearing helmets. Good. But, annoyingly to Cathree, they were maintaining some distance. Sonar Taxlaw was standing on the boulder, waving them off. She'd been joined by Einstein, who was doing likewise. That was about to become an intolerably crowded boulder, because Tayora Tom Lake was wading out to join them with that pizza box under one arm. He had managed to equip himself with a dry suit, which probably made the experience a good deal more comfortable for him. Cantabrigia V and Arjun were on the shore, facing out to sea, as if there were not a high-pitched battle going on a few hundred meters above them. Two of the buckies dislodged themselves from their positions above Cath 3 and began rolling down the slope like wire-frame boulders. At first this seemed uncontrolled, like an avalanche, but then they began to stretch and deform in a way that accommodated the rocky ground rushing beneath them and slowed to a mincing style of descent. One of them perched on a spot where it could get a clear view of the entire cove, and the other picked its way down to the sand, angling for close-ups, apparently. Cantabrigia V turned toward it and advanced a few steps. Facing squarely into its camera, she began speaking words that Cath 3 had no hope of hearing at this distance. Cath 3 saw all of this while leaning back against the steep pitch of the inner crater wall. Just above her was a line of vegetation that had taken root along its brow, where the ground was level and the sunlight was as plentiful as it would ever get in these parts. It spread for some tens of meters to her left and to her right, walling off the cove from the bog and the high country above. Some loud grunting noises and the sound of a lot of little sticks getting damaged caused her to look sharply to her left, just in time to see two large men, locked together, erupt through the wall of brush and tumble out into the open. Since the slope below was steep, they rolled together for several meters down toward the beach before the larger one, Bellad, was able to lash out with one foot and plant it downslope, bringing both of them to a stop. At the same time, he pushed up with both arms, shoving his opponent, a Neoander, completely off the ground in a bid to flip him backward and send him tumbling down even farther. But the Neoander seemed to anticipate this and made his much longer arms whip around Bellad's torso, scrabbling for purchase on his ribcage. Perhaps 50% of Bellad's body was still covered by ambots, locked together to form a patchy carapace. The Neoander's right hand came down on a cluster of them that was protecting Bellad's armpit, and those obliged their owner by delivering a clearly audible shock to the offending hand. This disrupted whatever grapple the Neoander had been attempting. Still, Bellad's gambit had basically failed, and he ended up toppling backward as his opponent's momentum overthrew him. When he understood this, he stopped fighting it and bent his knees, turning what might have been an ungainly sprawl into something more like a back somersault that employed the Neoander's stomach as an impact cushion. Cath3 heard a snapping noise, but was a little slow to understand it as a rib being broken. The Neoander, on his back, involuntarily tried to contract into a fetal position, bringing his head up into Bellad's descending fist. The contact between the delicate structures of the modern hand and the massive bone arches of the Neanderthal's skull was unequal, and there was more cracking, to Bellad's disadvantage. Still, the blow gave the Neoander a jolt, which was enough time for Bellad finally to draw a knife from a sheath and press it against the other's throat. He kept pressing until the Neoander's head was against the ground. The fighting, at least that part of it, was over, and Cath3 was able for the first time to process a full image of Bellad's state. Bloody, half-naked, spitting teeth, breathing much faster than he ever did when sprinting flat out on a treadmill. Anyway, he was alive, and the fight was over for him, unless he chose to neutralize his opponent by cutting his throat, which seemed inadvisable, since he was now under the direct coverage of a bucky with a camera in it. The ancient Teclan Neoander fights of asteroid mining lore might have ended with throat cutting, but not this one. Other things happened in the bog that she did not see. Langobard emerged with Roscoe's Yor slung over his back in a fireman's carry and began tromping down the slope in some haste, not looking back. Bellad, watching, called out a warning to him. In the same instant, Cath heard movement from the bog and saw a human silhouette, not a Neoander, vault through the gap that had been torn in it by Bellad and his opponent and begin running after Bard. She was a squat woman with close-cropped hair in military kit, a classic bee. Cath3 aimed her catapult at her and fired an ambot, then two more, but all of them somehow missed. The bee was evidently wearing some kind of armor that was good at spoofing this particular model, and so she could stand there all day shooting at her, and nothing would happen. Still, the bee heard the catapult go whang, and sensed the ambots zipping around her, which was enough to stall her for a moment. She turned toward Cat 3. The look on her face suggested that she had not expected to see a female Moirin. As she was taking in this extraordinary spectacle, a fist-sized rock struck her on the downhill side of her head and, to all appearances, killed her. Cathree looked down the slope to see Belid following through from having thrown the rock. He had transferred his unbloodied knife to his broken hand and now shifted it back. Nearby was Bard, who had paused in his headlong sprint toward the beach and turned around to see what Belid was throwing rocks at. Blood seemed to be draining out of him. On second thought, it was draining out of Sergeant Major Ure. The Neoander that Belid had been restraining rolled up to his feet. Just as rapidly, he went down again, and a catapult whang traveled up to Cathree's ears. When Langobard turned around, he saw that Roscoe's Ure, badly mauled but still conscious, had brought his weapon into play with his free hand. If there were other Red forces to be accounted for, they were either dead, unconscious, or in retreat toward the mountains. For the first time in what seemed like a while, but had probably been just a few seconds of elapsed time, Cathree directed her attention to what was going on below. The rubber boats from the Ark had made a decision to avoid the middle of the cove. Instead, they were splitting to either side to make landfall on the prongs formed by the crater's rim. From there, they could hike around if need be. A person was walking out of the water. Ty handed the pizza box up to Einstein and told him to open it and to keep what was inside of it dry and near to hand. The dry suit was doing a fine job of keeping his legs warm, and so he decided to remain below, thigh deep in the water next to the islet. His time in the war had left him with distrust, bordering on disgust, with people like Cantabrigia V, who were always thinking about the narrative. But that way of thinking was infectious. He saw the little scene on the islet through the eyes not of Tyura Tom Lake, but of a video camera beaming coverage to the ring. And he thought it looked perfect the way it was. The small conical spike of glass, grubby around the waterline with wave-washed sand, supporting two people. Einstein with the pizza box, and, standing next to him with a finger hooked through his belt loop, the psych with one headphone on and the other off. In fact, he attended so closely to the image that he almost missed the main event. The look on the others' faces told him he had best turn around and look out to sea. Only the head and shoulders were protruding above the waves. The pinger was trudging up the sloping floor of the crater as if returning from a casual underwater stroll. He or she breathed loudly and deeply for a little while, apparently reoxygenating, but then settled down to a more normal respiration. Where did they live? Where had this person come from? They must have diving bells or something that moved about underwater. The pinger was hairless and sleek, and, as soon became evident, lacked external genitalia. So, a woman? But if so, it was a woman without breasts, and as far as Ty knew, these were still mammals. A few paces behind was a roundish object that presently turned out to be supported by a neck, which turned out to be anchored in a sloping pair of shoulders. This one did have breasts, and behind her was yet a third person of the same general description. As the first one ascended into shallower water, the shape of his body became clearer, round, and in general, sort of projectile-like. Some part of Ty's brain wanted to identify him as a fat man, and maybe he was fat, in the same way that an otter or a seal is, a thick layer of subcutaneous fat held in beneath a taut, rather thick-looking skin. But in no way did he seem flabby or jiggly. His overall style of movement suggested heavy musculature hidden beneath that smooth jacket of, for lack of a better word, blubber. Basically naked, he did have a kind of web harness strapped around his torso, with a sufficient number of odds and ends attached to it to make it clear that he was a technological being. At first, the pingers had seemed black, but as they came out of the water, it became clear that their skin was dark gray and mottled with patches of lighter gray, shading toward blues and greens. Their bellies were of lighter hue than their backs, and the mottling tended to run up their sides. Ty didn't like to stare, but he couldn't help it. Nothing was visible between their legs save a system of concentric folds within which, Ty assumed, a fairly normal set of genitalia must be hiding, perhaps just awaiting a suitable invitation to present themselves. They were drawing close enough now that their faces could be looked at. The underlying skulls probably looked the same as those of rootstock humans, but eyes, ears, and nostrils were guarded by a system of muscled flaps that were always in some amount of motion. Sonar Taxlaw's early remark about breeding wolves into poodles had been a bit indelicate, but the analogy held up. These people were to more ordinary humans as bulldogs were to hounds. All the same stuff was there. You just had to look for it a little harder. Ty turned back to look at Einstein and Sonar. Understandably, they had eyes only for the approaching pingers. "Einstein," he said. Then louder, "Einstein!" Startled, Einstein nearly fell into the water, then focused on Ty. "Do you want it?" he mouthed, nodding at the rectangle gripped in his hands. "No," Ty said. "It has to be a child of Ivy."
"Now?"
"Now." Einstein gripped the thing's bottom corners in his hands and held it up above his head so that the approaching visitors could get a clear view of it. It was a picture, blown up to about half a meter square. Any spacer would recognize it as an iconic image from the epic. It was the last photograph that Ivy's fiancé, Cal Blankenship, had texted to her from the conning tower of his submarine moments before closing the hatch and diving to escape from the opening salvo of the hard rain. The image was dominated by two concentric circles. In the middle distance, the aperture of the open hatch, framing a disk of sky already split in two by the fiery trace of a bolide. Surrounding that, much closer to the camera, the engagement ring that he had just removed from his finger. The question was whether Cal's descendants would recognize it. The lead pinger's face unfolded a little, his gray eyes seeming to become larger, his ears blooming from mere slits into something more resembling normal human ears, except smaller and sleeker. He stopped trudging in knee-deep water. The other two drew abreast of him. All three were gazing up at the picture held aloft by the shivering Ivan. Ty's ears were tickled by high-pitched vocalizations that were almost recognizable as English words. The pingers were talking to one another, turning their heads to exchange remarks, pointing at the picture, gesticulating broadly. Of course, people who spent a lot of time underwater would become good at talking with their hands. The female pinger said something emphatic, getting the attention of the other two. Ty couldn't understand the words, but the tone and the body language were emphatic. "Shut up. Listen. I know what this is." She held her left hand in front of her body. The palm was elongated, the fingers were stubby, and when she spread them apart, slightly webbed. With her right hand, she enclosed the ring finger of the left and pantomimed sliding a ring off. She held the imaginary ring aloft, then brought her left hand up to her face and twitched her index finger once, pretending to take a picture. Kathree felt herself, as she watched all of this, sliding down the slope on her ass in a semi-controlled manner, almost afraid that she might scare the pingers away with a sudden movement. Bard had reached the lower camp quicker and laid Sergeant Major Yore out on a sleeping bag, where Hope was attending to him, already hooking up an intravenous tube. Kathree passed by Bellet, who was straddling the helpless red Neoander, putting huge plastic ties on his ankles and wrists. She made it down to the beach, keeping well clear of Cantabrigia 5, who was speaking into a camera, and Arjun, who was just watching and mumbling into his VARP. Several more pingers had waded up into the shallows. One of them, a male strapped with more gear than the others, had approached Ty and seemed to be trying to communicate with him. Ty was grinning, but he kept cupping a hand around his ear and shaking his head. The pinger reached out, gently took Ty's wrist, and plucked at the black stuff of his dry suit. Ty responded by mimicking the same gesture on the slick skin of the pinger's arm. Both of them laughed. The pinger's teeth were white, and they were sharp. The first three pingers had come ashore on the islet and were inspecting the photograph, which Einstein was holding now in front of his chest, part invitation and part shield. Sonar Taxlaw, not so encumbered, faced off uncertainly against the female pinger, who suddenly stepped forward and embraced her. On the beach, Cantabrigia V exchanged a satisfied look with Issa Arjun and glanced toward the sky.